since 1775,
generations of Americans have fought
for our ideals and our principles.
American warriors secured the freedoms to create the United States of America.
They fought to end slavery.
They joined with allies to win two world wars.
They have responded with valor and honor whenever called. And they have liberated more people around the globe than any military in the history of the world.
Our all-volunteer forces of guardsmen,
soldiers,
sailors,
marines,
airmen, and reservists continue the mission begun
at Lexington and Concord.
Less than 1% of Americans serve in our armed forces.
The least the rest of us can do is to pay attention and get engaged.
This program is produced and broadcast for that purpose.
It is presented live and worldwide at 1041thetruth.com.
To engage, call 520-751-1041.
The American Warrior is on the air.
Good afternoon, Tucson. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia, for another segment of American Warrior Radio. Hey, we've got a really, really special guest, and I'm somewhat embarrassed, actually. I've known this gentleman for a long time, and in preparing for the show, I've discovered, Keith, that there's a lot of stuff I don't know. So we'll get to our guest, Keith Comer, Colonel Keith Comer, here in just a second. But as you know, we like to remind people a little bit about history, and in particular, this is a piece of history that a lot of us have come to be used to over the course of time, but you may not actually know where it came from. And on this date in 1942, Congress established something they called wartime, which we now know today as daylight savings time. It was suggested by President Roosevelt to conserve fuel. It actually traced back even as far as World War I when the United States established a standard time all across the country. The 1918 Standard Time Act was meant to be in effect for only 7 months of the year, but continued on through the war. Daylight Savings Time, or War Time, was repealed on September 30th, 1945, when individual states once again imposed their own standard time. Now, if you've been in Arizona for a while, you know we don't have Daylight Savings Time here. We have Arizona Time, but some of you may not know the origins of Daylight Savings Time tracing back to this state and military history. So today, I tell you what, I am really, really excited to have someone I lost track of for several years. But I got to tell you, folks, ladies and gentlemen, this guy is just a Renaissance man is maybe not the right word. But today in the studio, we have Colonel Keith Comer, who is officially the Air National Guard Advisor, the commander of the 12th Air Force. We've had some 12th Air Force folks on before, Keith, but we'll give you a chance to explain to people what your job is there. Keith was commissioned in 1989 after graduating from MIT with a Bachelor of Science in Aeronautical and Astronautical Engineering. He also holds two Masters of Science degrees, one in Aerospace Engineering and one in Telecommunications Engineering, both from the University of Colorado Boulder. He's a command pilot with more than 5,200 flight hours and over 70 aircraft. That's right, folks, you heard me correctly, 70 aircraft, everything from helicopters to fighters to bombers. 2,000 of those hours were flight test hours, and that's one of the things we want to spend some time talking with Keith about here. So, Keith, welcome to American Warrior.
Ben, thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Let's just get out of the way right now. You and I wouldn't say we grew up together, but we knew each other in previous lives.
Yeah, that's correct. In fact, a small world story, your mom was my high school English teacher and taught me Spanish, and your dad was a pastor at our church. And the first time I think I had made a trip to Tucson, which was back in 1982 or 83, you drove me down here to attend summer sessions at the University of Arizona. So full circle all the way back around. It's great being here in Tucson.
But that doesn't mean I could take any credit whatsoever for your success.
Well, you could take a little.
Yeah, very little, microscopic little. Now, Keith, this is just fascinating. I guess part of what I'm embarrassed about is you're right. We connected back up through the 12th Air Force when you accepted this new assignment here. But you'd been in Tucson a while. I'd been in Tucson a while. But we literally hadn't. I don't think we'd seen each other since back when I was going to U of A and you were still in high school. But it is a small world. But as I got to figure out what Keith Comer had done in those intervening years, I got to tell you, I am so humbled. I'm so proud of what you've been able to achieve. I mean, you truly are, you're a poster boy. And literally, you've got some photos there on the desk to autograph here for folks after the show.
I'd be glad to. I've been just super, super fortunate. And some people will say I was in all the wrong places at all the wrong times or the right places at the right times, depending on your perspective. But my whole career has basically leveraged one assignment to the next, and I've had some wonderful mentors and leaders that I've worked for that have really opened the door for me. And that started all the way back up in Round Valley and in the White Mountains in Arizona.
Now, talk about that. You've had, by my count, looking at your bio, 21 different assignments. Is that because of the nature as a test pilot? Is that unusual for this time in your career? Is that about average?
No, that's pretty typical. So an officer in the Air Force, whether you're or an enlisted member for that matter, although their assignments tend to turn over a little bit slower than ours do, but in any specialty, whether you're maintenance or engineering, program management, or a pilot, we tend to move jobs probably every 12 to 18 months. That doesn't necessarily mean we move locations. So a lot of times on my background, you'll see that I've had multiple assignments. Some of those are in the same location. So the Air Force is obviously very big about preparing individuals for greater responsibility, teaching them to become experts in their career field, and then giving them the leadership experience as well. So those particular moves up are tailored. They're targeted for those individuals to move along a particular path. And so that's what does it. The more senior you get in the officer career field, you tend to move locations actually about every 18 to 24 months, and throw in a few deployments overseas, and you can see the tempo for some of our personnel is quite high.
Now, you let's get the elephant in the studio out of the way right now. As I go through your extensive bio, I see a lot of classifieds we can't talk about. So kind of just sort of walk through, folks, from your graduation real quickly to where you are now, because you've had, it's a very intriguing path, and you're right, you kind of joke about being in the wrong place at the right time, but you've done a lot of diverse things from satellites to test pilot to actual flying in combat.
You bet.
So kind of walk folks through that path so they understand how Keith Comer got where he did.
Well, like you said, I grew up in the White Mountains here in Arizona. I consider myself pretty much an Arizona native and was fortunate enough to get a ROTC scholarship and accepted to MIT. And I really wanted to do that, not so much for the caliber of the school, although that's obviously a huge benefit and getting that great education and the name to go with it. But the big thing for me was to just do something a little bit different. Get out of the small town, go to the East Coast. And my first assignment out of ROTC at MIT was a 9-month delay, believe it or not, to come on active duty. And I ended up getting recruited to work out at Hanscom Air Force Base in just outside of Boston. And I worked for a man there, Roger Mosley, who was one of the first F-117 test pilots.
Wow. And that's the stealth fighter.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah, and he started that program way back in the mid-70s. And he was just one of these great leaders, a great mentor. And he knew he was only going to have me for 9 months, but he instilled in me a couple of things that I took on. And one of those was I was really interested in math and science and engineering. Mm-hmm. And he said, you need to go be a test pilot. And at the time, he had just finished up being the deputy director of the B-2 program and took me out for the first flight of the B-2 out at Palmdale, and I was basically hooked at that point. So, but my flying path was very atypical for how somebody gets to test pilot school, because when I came back on active duty 9 months after I was working for him, the Air Force had too many pilots in the Air Force, and they said, you can get out and you know, thanks for playing for 4 years, or you can go do a desk job, and we'll try to get you back to pilot training in 4 or 5 years. And so that's the path I took. I basically took a secondary assignment in the space business, waiting to go to pilot training.
Okay, we'll be talking more about that odd path and how it led you to be the first pilot of a, I mean, can we call you an astronaut?
Not quite.
Okay.
Yet.
Ladies and gentlemen, test pilot Colonel Keith Comer, right here on American Warrior. We'll be right back.
Those who expect to reap the blessings of freedom must, like men, undergo the fatigue of supporting it. Now, back to the American Warrior.
Welcome back, folks. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia, on American Warrior. Another beautiful Tucson day with a beautiful Tucson guest. Handsome. How's that? You're a poster child, Keith. You are. Come on. The picture's right there. Yeah, see, these guys, I tell you, one thing, they're so humble. These men and women of our military are so humble. We're back with Colonel Keith Comer. He is, among other things, a test pilot and had a lot of firsts in his careers. But, Keith, just before we took the break, you were talking about kind of how you got into, how you became a test pilot. And it is, if I understand correctly, it's sort of a combination of you self-select, you have an interest, but then also someone in leadership says, you know, based on what I've seen about you and your characteristics, this might be something you want to try. Is that?
Yeah, that's correct. You basically start out as an operational pilot in your airframe, whether it's an F-16 or C-17, and they'd like you to get 8 or 10 years of experience. And then they're looking for an engineering degree or a hard science degree for a bachelor's. And then typically most of the guys are going to have masters that are technical as well, and gals. Obviously, we have female test pilots and flight test engineers.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's a selection process. And guy, the stronger pilots typically in the Air Force and the Navy either do one of two things. They either go to weapons school, which is fighter weapons school up at Nellis, which is where we train our best tacticians. Those folks lead guys out into combat and do all the weaponeering for the squadron. And then there's folks that go to test pilot school. And back in the 60s, guys did both. My interest in science, technology, and math was one of the things that I think, and some prodding from some mentors and folks that were helping me along the way, was always something of interest to me. But I ended up in the Guard flying. And even though I started in active duty, I spent 6 years flying with the 120th Fire Squadron out of Buckley in Colorado.
And now why?
And that was, again, because of this.
Because they stand up slots in the active
slots.
Duty.
Okay. And I'd done about 2 years working as a satellite engineer with Air Force Space Command, and Buckley was converting from old A-7s to new F-16s. And my former boss, Roger Mosley, knew the squadron commander up there, made some introductions, and I ended up going to pilot training with the Guard. And that's probably the first watershed moment that really mm-hmm. got me on the path that I'm on, which brought me to Tucson, and I worked a flight test here with an organization called AATC, the Air National Guard Air Force Reserve Command Test Center, which is over at the International Airport tenant unit, not part of the 162nd Fighter Wing, but worked strongly with them. And they brought me down as a young guy with really no experience in flight tests and let me do hands-on operational tests for about 3 years. And I had a great boss there who pushed me as the first Guard candidate to go to test pilot school. And I was selected.
Ever. Wow.
And I was selected and went back on active duty for the second time. And that's a theme with me. I've been back and forth several times between the active duty and the reserves and the Guard. Ended up at test pilot school fairly late in my career. Most guys go at about the 10-year point. I went with 13 years in service. And that caused some grief because, you know, from a progressions perspective, after I graduated from test pilot school, to keep me on timeline, they basically put me right into a director of operations job, which was the number two job in the squadron. And that was with the F-16 test squadron out at Edwards.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's something on here called undergraduate space training. And at first glance, it's, okay, wait a minute, he's a pilot, space training, that's, I kid you about being an astronaut, but doing some research into that organization, it's really pretty fascinating, tracing all the way back to, you know, the Soviet, the space race, the Cuban Missile Crisis, all that stuff is thrown in there. Can you tell us about that program and what?
Absolutely, and it still goes on today. I think it might be called undergraduate space and missile training, but pilots have a year-long training course called undergraduate pilot training, where you basically earn your wings and learn how to fly the basic Air Force airframes, T-6 now and T-38 or T-1. But for space operators, they have a similar curriculum. It's about 6 months long. I was one of the last class that went to Lowry Air Force Base in Denver, and they teach you satellite operations, orbitology, Keplerian theory, all the things.
Yeah, I was going to bring that up. Yeah.
Just my one big word for today. But they teach you all the things you need to know that you may not have gotten in an undergraduate education to work in the space business.
In layman's terms, though, then, are you being taught to operate things in space or operate in space yourself or all the above?
Typically, that course is for people that are going to operate things in space. So our comm satellites, our weather satellites, our early warning satellites. That's the intro level, and at some point they merged and they actually started teaching our missileers how to run missile operations in that course as well. So it's the intro level course that prepares you for a career in the Space Command. It was good. I learned a lot out of it, and it opened doors for me later, which is why I ended up with this weird career between space and fighter operations, then became TESS, then it became TESS of Space Systems. And that's why I said, you know, it all goes back to kind of the one step after the other vignettes that I've had throughout my career.
Folks, we've got a real American hero, fascinating career, Air Force, Air National Guard, space, his civilian life. If you'd like to ask him a question or comment, 751-1041. Colonel Keith Comer is live with us in the studio. So, Keith, coming back to that, you know, we talked on the show. In fact, we run a commercial about the importance of the civilian airmen, the guard and the reserves. But you really have had an intriguing ballet, if you will, back and forth and back and forth between the two that seems somewhat unique as far as a career path.
Yeah.
Is that?
And that's true. You know, now we use a buzzword, total force integration or TFI, and I like to think I was doing total force integration since day one. You know, I basically was in a position everywhere I went with sponsorship in terms of the bosses I had to be able to pick my follow-on assignment and go to a job that could build my capabilities and where I could kind of grow into what I've become today.
Is that not usually the case, though?
That's rare. Yeah, that's rare. Okay. And that's why I said that part of it's hard work and positioning yourself, but it was a lot of luck. And I've had just some wonderful bosses and coworkers. You know, I'll tell you, even the guys I work with today, they're instrumental in sometimes helping you get to that next step. So, yeah, definitely atypical, but it's worked out for the best.
So at which point now that you're officially a test pilot, I just find it interesting knowing a little bit about aircraft. I mean, the variety, over 70 aircraft, everything from fixed wing to rotor to stuff you probably can't even talk about. How does that, are you just sitting around one day and someone comes in and shows you a blueprint and say, we don't think you can fly, but Keith, go out and strap it on? I mean,
those used to be the days, and I think that's what we're all nostalgic about in the 60s when you could fly 6 or 7 airplanes in a week. And those pilots back then, by the way, were much better pilots. And there's a lot of retirees here in town that are from the 50s and 60s and 70s fighter community. And they have real skills. Those airplanes were hard to fly, mechanical flight controls, a lot of forces, not all the digital computer stuff we have today. We like to say we're smarter at the systems and the ones and zeros, but getting the chance to fly all the airplanes is a product of a couple things for me. I was a civilian pilot growing up, and so I've flown a lot of general aviation aircraft as well. And actually, if you throw those in there, it's probably 120 or 130 airplanes.
Holy cow.
On the military side at test pilot school, during that year, one of the things they do is prepare you to adapt very quickly to a new airframe. They're preparing you to do a first flight in the F-35 or whatever comes after that. And so to do that, they're going to show you all different kinds of airplanes, and they're going to show you good airplanes with good flying qualities, so F-16, F-22, F-15, and they're going to show you bad airplanes, things that we ended up having to make a lot of blivets and modifications and changes to make them fly well. And so in that one-year period, you might get to fly 20 or 30 different aircraft, and that's a real interesting part about it.
Now, we've got a caller. Tim, before I put you on the air, Tim, just a qualifier here. The nice thing about American Warrior and having these great guests in is sometimes they just have to say straight up, that's something I can't talk about. So if Keith's okay with that, Tim, you're on the air with American Warrior. I think. Well, we lost Tim. But Tim's question, if you're able to answer it, Keith, was, what is your opinion about the supersonic missile? Is that an accurate description? Hypersonic? What is?
Yeah, and I'm not super familiar with actually what Tim was interested in. You know, everybody's working to build faster, better missiles out there, and the Chinese are no exception. Obviously, a very capable technology partner, but other than that, I really don't know much about the program.
I was actually literally having a discussion with someone about submarines this week, and he was talking about a Soviet submarine that could allegedly go to some god-awful depth, 3,000 feet below the ocean. I asked him, well, why on earth would you even want to go that deep? And he said, because we don't have a weapon that can get that deep. It's like, Is there an equivalent in space or not anymore with the airborne laser system? And
yeah, it's tough. You know, there's some treaties out there that prohibit targeting other people's stuff in space because a lot of it's safety related, GPS, weather,
sure.
Think about things like that. So countries that may or may not be working on those things probably wouldn't discuss them anyway. But yeah, space and very deep under the water are kind of our last final frontiers, if you will, and we talk about them that way. And you see a lot of the explorers out there, a gentleman I work for, Richard Branson, for the last couple of years, very very big into space and underwater exploration. And you see a lot of folks working on technologies, not only to augment military capabilities in those arenas, but to take passengers or tourists to see those parts of the environment.
Well, now, since you brought that up, let's talk about that. I have a press release here dated October 27, 2011. Virgin Galactic selects first commercial astronaut pilot from competition. 50 years ago, a historic competition for the first pilots to fly into space yielded the Mercury 7 astronauts. Today, from an intense selection process with more than 500 applicants, including some of the best pilots in the world, Virgin Galactic has selected former United States Air Force test pilot Keith Comer as the first astronaut pilot to join the Commercial Space Lines flight team. So you are an astronaut, kind of, sort of.
Kind of, sort of.
Rocket Man?
Yeah, the marketing department's really good at first, as you can imagine.
Well, tell us the real story. I mean, your picture's right here, and it says Virgin Galactic, and I don't guess that Richard Branson got to where he is by making bad calls.
No.
Absolutely not. Fewer bad calls than good calls, probably.
Yeah, absolutely. It goes back to, again, folks that you meet along the way, and it turns out that Scaled Composites, which is Burt Rutan's outfit in Mojave, if you know who he is, designed a lot of neat general aviation airplanes. And in 2004, with Paul Allen from Microsoft, they put together a venture to win what was called the XPRIZE, which was to fly three passengers into space twice in 2 weeks. And it was a $10 million prize, and they were successful. And about the time that was going on, Sir Richard was working on the Atlantic Global Flyer with Steve Fawcett, and Scaled was also building that out at Mojave, and they saw the spaceship behind the curtain and decided that they were going to do the same thing and put tourists into space.
Yeah, I don't know how you guys do it in the aviation world, but in radio, that's what we call a teaser. Folks, we are here with the first commercial pilot to be assigned to the Virgin Galactic spacecraft, Keith Comer. Live, give us a call, 751-1041. This is your host, Ben Buehler-Garcia. We'll be right back after this break.
To reap the blessings of freedom must, like men, undergo the fatigue of supporting it. Now back to the American Warrior on 104.1 The Truth.
You know, it's good that I have a test pilot astronaut guy in the studio. When that happened, we don't know what. We're all looking at each other. What the heck was that? What do they call that in the your business?
Scintillation.
Wow. That's too big. Scintillation. Wow, that's two big
words. Second big word for today. Well, I'll take some heat for that. I'm sure it works.
That's MIT and that teacher at Round Valley High School doing her job. So coming back, Keith, we're talking about it's hard to imagine someone not having heard about Virgin Galactic, but it does happen. So take us back and give us a Reader's Digest version, the objective, the philosophy, and then let's talk a little bit about the actual equipment. So what is Virgin Galactic? What is the objective, the mission of the organization?
Yeah, Virgin Galactic's one of Richard Branson's many companies. And the basic thesis is he grew up in an era when we thought everybody was going to be flying in space by 2010. Mm. And he was very passionate about anything he could do to bolster that particular activity. And so he decided to form this company after seeing the XPRIZE being won out at Mojave in 2004 and partnered with Scaled Composites to build a bigger vehicle. The first one was called Spaceship One. Second one, not very novel, Spaceship Two. Mm. But you go from three passengers to two pilots and six passengers, and you have a business model. The neat thing about the technology is it's readily available today. It's a basically commercial business jet type of technology, carbon fiber being the primary structure used. And the kind of the neat thing about the model is instead of having a really big rocket that's on the ground and that takes a lot bigger bucks to get off the ground, they used an air launch model similar to what they mm-hmm. do with Spaceship One. So we had two airplanes, still do, out at Mojave. One is White Knight 2, which is what we call the mothership, and it's a twin fuselage, all carbon fiber aircraft, 140-foot wingspan, so about the size of a 757. And that, because it's a twin fuselage, think P-40 P-38 or something similar. Right. We have a center location where we could mount the spaceship. We haul it up to 50,000 feet and drop it, and as it glides away, similar to Chuck Yeager in the X-1 or Scott Crossfield in the X-15, we light the rocket, and we go up. Rapid acceleration, and it's basically a pure vertical trajectory. So we're not going anywhere, but we're basically providing people access to out of the atmosphere for about 4.5 minutes, and that's all zero-G flight, a big parabola. It's basically a vertical shot up and back down, and it ends up being about a two-hour experience overall.
Okay, folks, if you have a question, give us a call, 751-1041. Colonel Keith Comer is live with us in the studio and available to chat with you or answer your questions. So, Keith, you said two things. That we're not going anywhere, but you are going into space. Is there – I didn't pay attention in school like you did, but is there a definable – at which point are you in the upper atmosphere and at which point are you in space?
Yeah.
Is there a
– The Air Force back in the X-15 days used, I think it was 86 nautical miles.
Okay.
We use we're using 100 nautical miles – 100 kilometers and 86 kilometers. And so that's basically where the FAA recognizes that there's no longer sufficient atmosphere. You have to do something different than being a pilot. And it's defined as space flight. And so in theory, even our passengers would get astronaut wings by going on that particular venture.
So really the definition is that there's certain aerodynamic things that happen with flaps and lift and thrust and wings that no longer apply. When you're at that point,
that's correct.
Interesting.
And so one of the neat things for me was the piloting challenges. You go from atmospheric normal flight, flying an airliner or flying something that's like a fighter aircraft, and you fly it like a fighter through a boosted profile, but then out of the atmosphere, you're basically a point mass that can't go anywhere. You're not translating once the rocket motor shuts off, but you have thrusters and you can control orientation, so pitch rolling yaw.
Do you think, Keith, given your, because again, it's interesting to me, your background, just the different type of aircraft that you've been involved in piloting, do you think that might have been an advantage in that competition with the 500 pilots where it was clear that you're used to saying, okay, this is what this machine does, but I'm okay with that machine doing something
different. Absolutely. And one of the requirements for the position was that you had flown big airplanes and smaller planes, and they wanted guys who had flown aircraft that were not what we will call modern aircraft, because this spaceship and White Knight both are reversible flight controls. They're more akin to what we did in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. So as a pilot, you feel all the forces on the controls. The air loads are pushing back. There's no hydraulics. There's no digital flight control computer. And I had some experience on some older airplanes, and I think that was one of the things that made me competitive.
We're going to get to our caller, Brian, here. But in essence, I pay Richard Branson a handsome sum of money.
Mm-hmm.
I go to New Mexico,
correct,
which is where the spaceport is being built,
correct,
and get on this aircraft. You guys take me up, shoot up, and so I'm in space weightless for how long?
It's going to be on the order of 4 or 5 minutes.
Okay. And do you actually unbuckle people? You don't have
to? That's the plan. Of course, as you know, we're still in flight test. Virgin's done 3 powered flights in the last year and making really good progress. The intent is shirt sleeve environment, no pressure suits. The vehicles are designed very, very tightly so that they don't leak and have some neat safety systems. But Richard wanted everybody to have the opportunity to experience the, the purest sensation of floating through the cockpit during the trip.
Along those lines, Brian is our caller. It's 751-1041. Brian, what's your question for Colonel Keith Comer?
He says right now it's, like a 2.5 hour flight and, experience. But how long do you think it's going to be until we actually get tourists to go into sustained orbit?
Yeah, that's a great question, Brian. The challenges, and that's why I said we're not going anywhere, and I use that facetiously, but it's not complicated to push a rocket into orbit. The hard part's getting back. And when you fly a vehicle into orbit, you're pushing orbital speeds of thousands and thousands of miles an hour. And when you come back, you have to get rid of all that energy to reenter the atmosphere, a la the space shuttle and some of the maneuvers and protection that they had on that vehicle. And that becomes very costly. It's very expensive to build. It's very expensive to maintain. Safety margins are much less. And it's not a great business model. So while I'm passionate about the theory and the concept behind it, I'm a realist, and I think that may still remain in the realm of governments for the time being.
Brian, thanks for your call today. Our American Warrior, 751-1041. If you'd like to ask a question, Keith, that I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think I read that you will not actually orbit the Earth.
That's correct.
You're just kind of going to go up and come back down again. But the logistics of that are such, I mean, you're taking off and landing at the same place, correct?
Exactly.
So what, while the Earth is rotating underneath you, what are you doing to get back without going around the block?
Right. Well, the Earth is spinning. You're absolutely correct. But the flight path is so short that the amount of movement underneath you is very small. So if you think about it, if you a normal cannonball profile where you shot a cannonball at a 45-degree angle and it lands somewhere downrange, keep tilting that cannon until it's pointed straight up. And at some point, it goes straight up, and it's going to come straight back down. And in theory, if the cannonball is airborne long enough, the Earth's going to rotate underneath it, and you'll see some displacement. So we have the same thing. The beauty of that profile is it gets you out of the atmosphere, and it gets you zero G. It gets you the view. You're at 100 kilometers, and you see the blackness of space and the curvature of the Earth. But you're not building up a lot of velocity. You're actually coming to zero speed and then starting to accelerate back down towards the atmosphere. And that acceleration determines material strength and structure and safety systems, and that amount is acceptable for the current technology and what we're trying to achieve.
An important safety tip: if you do shoot the cannon straight up and it comes right back down where it left from, that's a bad day, correct?
It is, exactly.
Okay, just checking. You're smarter than me.
I'll bring it up. One of the interesting things that Bert Rutan developed for Spaceship One was this concept of a feather, and the tail section of the spaceship actually folds up when you're out of the atmosphere, and that turns you basically into a badminton birdie. It controls your speed or your acceleration as you're coming through the upper atmosphere, and it makes the airplane stable. So if it wants to roll off to one side, there's more surface area over there, so it naturally rights the vehicle and keeps you pointed in the right direction. And that's one of the technologies that helps us get back into the atmosphere and then unfeather and turn it back into an airplane so we can glide back to the airport.
And things that we're already talking about, things way over my head. John, you have a call for Colonel Keith Colmer about the AT-16. John, what's your question?
Actually, I did see 38 shuttle launches, and I'm a big, huge fan of the shuttle program. But before that, they had the X-15 project, and it sounds like this is a very similar private adventure. And I just wanted to see if your wonderful guest could compare the X-15 by NASA to this program. And is NASA involved in this, or are they showing any interest in picking up Virgin Galactic as a contractor? It's a wonderful, wonderful program, and I'm really fascinated by the landing mechanism. It's much different than the X-15, but how would you compare the two programs, and what's NASA think about this? Thank you.
Yeah, you bet, John. Thanks for calling. The Spaceship Two actually flies a lot like X-15 on reentry. So when we come back as an airplane, a glider, just like the X-15 did. The speeds are a little slower just due to we have a little more surface area in the wing. But we're basically a flame-out glide approach, and we hit what's
that
called...
That doesn't sound good.
No.
Flame out is generally bad in aircraft, isn't it?
It is. And this is pre-designed that way.
Okay.
And the space shuttle is the same way. It comes back to what we call a high key position, which is a point overhead the field where it does basically a 360-degree spiral maneuver. We calculate the altitude we need to arrive at so that we can safely manage our energy all the way around. So it's very similar to the X-15. X-15 was slightly different in that it went a lot faster, and it was designed to develop a lot of the piloting strategies that we use today on spaceship and some of the materials that ended up on space shuttle, obviously the high-temperature materials. And X-15 did a lot more going somewhere. They would launch in Edwards and end up in Utah or vice versa, whereas we do more of the up, straight up and straight down approach. But and then lastly, I think NASA is interested, but this is a commercial effort, and I don't think we're going to put any NASA payloads into space from a long duration perspective, but we are going to do some suborbital rides for them, do some testing, low cost, that they can't do any other way.
Okay, Keith, you got them lighting up the boards here, folks. If you have a question, 751-1041. We're going to take a break. You can also email questions to us, and we'll address that when we come right back with Colonel Keith Colmer.
My daddy served in the Army. We lost his right eye, but he flew a flag out in our yard. Till the day that he died, he wanted my mother, my brother, my sister, and me to grow up and live happy in the land of the free.
discuss those who serve the red, white, and blue,
dial 520-751-1041.
If you want to support them,
start with WoundedWarriorProject.org.
Now, back to the American Warrior
on 104.1 The Truth.
And we're back in American Warrior. Hey, folks, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. I tell you what, I am honored all the time when we have guests in the show, but it's very rare that I've got someone I consider a friend and an American hero that is just so great to have him in the studio, and the time just flies by. So, Keith, we'll try and get you to answer these questions while we have time yet on our last segment here. The first was an email question someone sent in. They wanted some clarification about space debris, specifically meaning the junk that all these countries have kind of left floating up around there. Is that going to be an issue for you?
No, it shouldn't be. And there's a lot of space debris and a lot of old satellite parts and pieces in orbit, and it is a big problem that our Air Force Space Command and our joint commands are addressing with the international community. But typically, the big pieces and the small pieces that get as low as we are deorbit and burn in, and they basically burn up in the upper atmosphere, mostly ash, by the time it's all said and done, and not really a factor. I guess it could be, you know, a golden BB out there somewhere, but typically the environment that we operate in is such short duration, and it's so low compared to where things typically are. They're typically 3 or 4 times higher than us, even at the low altitude structure.
And for Keith, for folks that aren't familiar, explain the golden BB.
The golden BB is you're flying along in combat and somebody, you know, takes a random pot shot with a rifle or a small scale AAA piece and just happens to hit you. You run into it. It's coincidence. It's chance. Yeah. Highly unlikely. Not necessarily something you can prepare for and avoid. Typically the environment that Spaceship Two is going to operate in doesn't have any of those concerns. They do have safety systems that would allow them to take some structural damage and still bring the vehicle back safely. So that's been thought through.
Okay. And caller Mark is on there. You've got a question regarding the Lantern program and F-16s for our guest, Colonel Keith Comer. Mark, what's your question?
Yeah. I am. Yeah, well, we grew up in kind of, I guess, the sequential careers. I was in from 72 to 92, flew helicopters and fixed wing, and then had an engineering stint there at Wright-Patterson. And my program was Lantern, and I was wondering if you had any experience with it in your test pilot times.
I do. Great question, Mark. In fact, it's a good segue. I think some of the stuff we wanted to talk about. I grew up, the first targeting pod I flew was a Lantern. I never flew the nav pod, which for the listeners out there is another pod that I'll talk about both. The nav pod helps you navigate low altitude automatically in the F-16, and it basically flies you at 100 feet or 200 feet or whatever you select. You can do that in the weather at night. It's a neat system, and we've kind of gotten away from it. But the targeting pod piece of it is a sensor. Think of it as the eye in the sky that you see on the local helicopter. We mount it on the F-16, and it allows us to find targets on the ground. It allows us to find friendly forces, and it allows us to get coordinates so we can deliver GPS weapons or put a laser through the scene image and guide a laser-guided bomb. And you've seen a lot of the video on all the big news stations, during Desert Storm and Iraqi Freedom. But when I got to Tucson the first time as a test guy in 98, that was the first project I worked on, which was the successor to the Lantern pod, which was called Lightning, and worked with a wonderful bunch of engineers and leaders and test pilots here in town out of the International Airport at AATC. And that organization today still does all of the targeting pod development work for the predominance of the Air Force fleet. And we have two systems out there today, one made by Northrop Grumman called Lightning and one called Sniper made by Lockheed Martin. And, Mark, you'd be impressed with how far we've come along in terms of technology. And we're almost to the point where we're going to be running, you know, high-def 1080p images into the cockpit, and that's going to be some pretty neat stuff.
Yeah, great. Well, it sure seems like you had the dream career for me, so I'm glad somebody got it.
Oh, well, thank you.
Mark, that really.
Co-pilot, give me a call.
Roger that.
Just look up his bio. It really, truly, truly is impressive. So, Mark, thanks for your call to American Warrior.
Hey, good day, guys.
Now, Keith, coming back, there is something. You know, we started off the program talking about your somewhat odd very much not the Golden Beebe trajectory career path that you've had, but it's been, I don't want to say it's by chance, because I think a lot of it has to do with your skills, and you've seen opportunities and you've taken advantage of them. But one of the key factors there was the I think, you know, we introduced you as, in fact, in the bio from Virgin Galactic, it talks about a United States Air Force pilot, which is true. But tell us more about the Guardsmen and the reservists, and how important that is to our overall strategic defense now.
Yeah, and it, you know, it's near and dear to my heart, because the flexibility that the Guard has given me to do some of these things. Just to give you an example, I was leaving a test job here where I was on active duty in 2011. I got selected for Virgin Galactic, and you know, I was at the point where I could hang up my hat and retire. And a gentleman from the 162nd Fighter Wing at the Arizona Guard, who's now the commander of the Air National Guard, General Maxwell, said, "Hey, do you want to stick around and fly with us?" And, you know, I never thought that was even going to be an opportunity. Hmm. But, you know, you never burn any bridges. You know, sure. you be a good steward with the guys that you're flying with, and things will come back like that to help you. So that gave me the opportunity to be a citizen soldier, work out at Mojave doing flight tests for Virgin Galactic, and I commuted. I went to L.A. every Sunday night and came back Thursday night on Southwest, and flew here on Fridays. And so that's one aspect of the Guard, I think, that's really helped make my career what it is today.
I mean, I think it speaks to the fact that the 12th Air Force, the command, the headquarters here in Tucson, actually has a slot that deals with nothing but that liaison.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think it speaks to the growing importance of those, that segment of our military in the overall structure.
Yeah, absolutely. The reserves, you know, used to be a strategic reserve, you know. Mm-hmm. Citizen soldiers been there since the late 1700s, and it's a wonderful concept, and we still need that today. But the big change has come since 2001, and most of our reserve and guard components are having to put in a lot more time, whether it's locally to maintain proficiency, yeah, or train students, in the case of the 162nd Fighter Wing, or whether it's deploying and serving overseas. And I think the biggest challenge for our guardsmen today is just their personal ops tempo has changed. They're being asked to do a lot more, and they're standing up and volunteering, which is great. And Tucson's just a phenomenal city from a support to the military perspective.
Well, and I want to emphasize that point again, Keith. So I think you're somewhat of an extreme example, but nonetheless, it's the same parallel. I mean, you were taking time off from flying spacecraft-ish things,
yes,
to serve your country. That's the parallel. Is I'm working at UMC or at the machine shop somewhere, and my employer needs to give, yeah, me time off. Is that, talk just about the importance, and does that create any special strains?
It can.
You think on the.
It can. You know, because as an employee, you know, you hate to go in and tell Virgin Galactic I need next Friday off. But at the end of the day, they wouldn't have gotten the expertise. You're not going to find a test pilot with my background without going to the Navy,
sure,
or the Air Force. And so they're benefiting from all of the years of service, the training, the dollars invested to get us to that point. So, and it's similar whether you're talking to a medical professional here in town, you've got lawyers that go out and do legal work. And so we're leveraging very heavily those skill sets and capabilities that folks do day in and day out. And that's what makes the Guard and Reserve such a strong, strong force multiplier, because we maintain that very high level of expertise. But on a cost basis, in the long run, I think we're cheaper.
Okay. Now, you, again, we're coming back to the small world. You mentioned that one of our previous guests we had on just a few weeks ago, Spanky Peterson, one of the pilots that flew in on the Lone Survivor Rescue.
Yeah.
You work with him as well out there at the Guard.
I do, and I love Spanky, one of the great warriors we have here in town, and there's lots of them. And that's the thing about Tucson I don't think people know. There's a lot of legends in my mind, and a lot of my heroes that have retired that are here in town. We've got several Congressional Medal of Honor winners. We've got guys like Spanky Peterson that's plucking guys off mountainsides in Afghanistan. We've got great maintainers. We've got great personnelists. We've got great medical people that have all done these neat things, and it's just a great community, and we take care of each other, and we're proud to serve.
We've got just a couple minutes left, Keith. I've got two favors to ask. One is, go ahead and give me Richard Branson's cell number. I'll call him and get him on American Warrior. But number two, what do you want to tell people, being familiar with the area, not just being military, but being very familiar with Tucson and Arizona? What message, if you could leave the listeners with one, for the civilians out there in particular, what can they do to support you and your comrades and their families?
Yeah.
What are some simple things?
The simple things are support the base and the structures around you. You know, Davis-Monthan is a national asset. The 162nd Fighter Wing is a national asset. The airspace we have between here and Yuma and up to the north of us, national asset. You know, when you can argue against it if you disagree, and I get that, and I respect that. But I think one of the worst things we can do is support it in principle, but never speak out. And I will tell you, I don't feel that that occurs here in town. We get a lot of support from our folks. That's the thing. Vocalize your opinion and go out and vote.
You know, one of the little promos we talk about is those who want to enjoy freedom on occasion, they have to stand up and support it. And I'm glad you made that point. I just had a column recently in a local business newspaper that was trying to make that point about, look, we as civilians have a job to do as well, and that is to call things out and to stand up and hold our leaders' feet to the fire when we feel it's necessary. And I want to echo that. I think not just because historically, but I think you are a perfect example, Keith, of the potential that aerospace and flight still holds for Tucson, but darn it, this airport, this spaceport that is being built for your organization, guess what? It's being built in New Mexico. And I'm one of those people that said, you know what? I sure wish that was being built in Arizona, and we
yep.
missed it there. So, and you probably can't. That's politics. You can't die that. So, folks, thank you so much for tuning in. We hope you enjoyed it. Listen, if you hear about it or if you listen to the program and you want to share it, you can share it. It will be available on podcast if you go to 1041thetruth.com. Look up American Warrior Daily Mail, and this interview will be podcast. Keith, thank you so much for your service to our nation. Thanks for coming in, and God bless you. I hope you're up there. You make that first real flight with passengers real soon.
Thank you, and you're welcome, and thanks for having me on board today.
We'll be right back with Daily Mail. Thanks for tuning in, folks.